Show, the show that's all about integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative medicine cancer charity. Last week on the show, I featured samples from the sessions at the first weekend of our recent event, Your Life and Cancer 2020, that we put on in partnership with Progressive Communications. That first weekend focused on those new to integrative medicine. Our second weekend was entitled Expanding Your Knowledge, and today I'm going to lead you through samples of the sessions to give you the feel of the breadth and the depth of the content covered. To set the scene for this second weekend, I spoke to Dr. Robert Verkerk, Scientific Director of the Alliance for Natural Health and someone with a prodigious overview of the science of integrative medicine. Here he is finishing off the introductory session. I wanted to ask, after hearing the case for each of these approaches from all these leading scientists this weekend, I imagine it's going to be tempting to think it's essential to do everything. Could you say something about the individuality of people and their condition and the need to find the right approaches for you at each stage and how this could actually be far better than trying to carpet bomb the situation?
Yes. Look, we know a number of things. The quality of the therapeutic relationship is absolutely key. So if you get on very well with your clinician, it's about how you work with that clinician as a team, if you like, looking specifically at your own situation. So you're at the center of this situation, all the focus is looking at how you can start to regulate the body correctly. And we also know that most people cannot take on 30 or 40 different therapies together. And if they try and do that, they will always take on some therapies in a more rigorous manner than others. So prioritizing what you do, first of all, with the help and guidance. We very much support this idea of the clinician being the guide rather than the god. So it's not a sort of top-down approach, which is often happens a little too often in conventional oncology, but much more about how you get guided. So in doing that and making those choices, it's really important to know your history, your medical history, your genetic background, your epigenetic background. And there's a lot of clinicians now involved in doing some genetic tests to understand if you have particular issues with your book of life, if you like, that make you more susceptible, which can help inform strategies that should be prioritized.
Our next session got very specific about two integrative medicine therapies. Dr. Elizabeth Thompson, CEO of the Center for Integrative Medicine, spoke to Dr. Boris Hubenthal, oncologist and expert in both mistletoe and hypothermia, about what these strategies can add to cancer treatment. Here, Dr. Hubenthal introduces us to mistletoe as a cancer therapy.
And since then, of course, we have much preclinical and clinical data. So the mistletoe is the best scientifically evaluated medical plant on the globe. So there are thousands of preclinical and hundreds of clinical studies about the ingredients of mistletoe and how it could be beneficial in cancer and hematological malignancies.
Yeah, and I think it would be good to talk about the science. I often quote the big observational studies that have shown, first of all, that mistletoe, which, you know, we look into the trees, particularly in winter, and we see this beautiful plant growing like a ball. We also kiss under it. This is the mistletoe we're talking about. But it has some very powerful natural agents in it that have been found to stimulate the immune system, particularly the natural killer cells, which are our army of cells that can go around killing cancer cells. So in my clinical practice, I use it for about 12 months alongside conventional treatments, and sometimes beyond, depending what people want to do. But the science, we'll talk about this, but the observational data show that it's safe when combined with chemotherapy, radiotherapy, but it also appears to decrease some of the side effects like inflammation of the mouth or infection. Do you think you could just tell us a little bit more, Boris, about the science and what you think is really important?
Yes, at the beginning, I'm really happy that you mentioned the really unique botanical features of this plant, because I think this makes this plant really, really interesting, flourishing in the winter, having fruits in the winter, and growing against the light. So because it always appears as a ball on the trees, and it has different host trees, of course, and the host trees later on, they will determine the level of ingredients in the mistletoe fluid. And the science, of course, on the other hand, is specially done in the last, I think, 20 years. We have more than six reviews about the beneficial effects of mistletoe. And I'd like to point out two sorts of cancer where, from my point of view, the best evidence for the clinical use is existing. It's first the breast cancer, where it can reduce the side effects of chemotherapy. If you have to use adjuvant chemotherapy, we have a lot of problems causing due to therapy. And these side effects could be reduced. And this is, from my point of view, quite well been proved in the recent years. But, I'd like to focus on white blood cells. So neutropenic fever means fever which is induced due to chemotherapy, not due to the mistletoe. It can be reduced, and the quality of life, especially focused on fatigue problems, means being tired during to chemotherapy, could be or is reduced using mistletoe alongside to the chemo.
Now followed a session on one of the hottest topics in cancer and many other conditions, cannabis. We were fortunate to have two top specialists to talk about this. Professor Mike Barnes is a leading light in the UK in championing the cause of cannabinoids as medicine, and Professor Barcella is hugely invested in research into the applications of cannabis in cancer. Here, Mike Barnes talks about the availability of medicinal cannabis in the UK, after which Professor Barcella talks about the state of the evidence around cannabinoids in cancer.
Doctors in the UK have a reasonable choice, but not as wide as other countries, and I'm sure we'll hear about Israel soon. Certainly Canada and the countries where it's more widely available and recreationally available have a much bigger medical choice. We are still fairly limited in the UK with what sort of cannabis we can prescribe, although we still have a reasonable range of oils and some flower, or some people need vaping of flower. So we do have a reasonable choice, but not as much as some of the other countries that are a bit more advanced than the UK.
Mm. Okay, thank you. So, Professor Barcella, you've invested a lot into research in cannabis as a medicine. My understanding is that at this point in cancer, the evidence base for symptom management is quite impressive. It's growing all the time. Can you give us an overview of what it's been shown to help with, also indicating the components of the cannabis plant involved in each case?
Well, it's really to give you a wide, very wide look on this symptomatic relief of cannabis, because it's really, there is still a gap between the medical studies and the information that came from the people who use it. When we are dealing with randomized trial and so on. Most of them are very old, with dealing with medications that were in the past, for example, synthetic THC. Some of them are newer, with Sativex, that it's a combination of THC and CBD. But there are very few prospective trials that are dealing with the plant itself, with cannabis. So most of the studies are first retrospective and after it prospective, analyzing the data that came from people who are using cannabis and who are willing to share what's happened with them. There is through website or through telephone calls and so on. So we are now running a prospective trial, large prospective trial in Israel, where we are doing a really full evaluation of all the different symptoms before and during the use of cannabis. And there were others that were published in the past. So first of all, we need to say that around 15 to 20% of the patients, the cannabis is not working well for them, or they have side effects, or that it's not effective. So those people are usually not continue with cannabis, and it's happened during the first month. It's something that really comes up from each study. It's around the 15% of the patient. Now, I must say that now with the new regulation in Israel, you can change to different cannabis and maybe get those effects or reduce the side effects. But around 15% of the patients are stopping to use cannabis in the first month. Now, all the others are continue. And when we are doing the follow-up, we see a quite symptomatic relief with a different kind of symptoms. First of all, we need to know that in cancer, when we are speaking about supportive care or palliative care, it's quite different from a specific person that only have pain. So it's all related, the mood disturbance, the influence of the disease, the pains are all mixed together. And what we saw that actually almost all the symptoms are relieved. I must say in still unpublished data, but we saw that the rich CBD was better regarding also pain, that was quite surprising, appetite and mood disturbance. THC was much better for sleep. So if you are the main problem is sleep, maybe you need something that rich with THC. The combination, the equivalent combination that we have in Israel of CBD and THC was less effective than both of them.
Our next speaker can take the credit for single-handedly reviving serious interest in the metabolic theory of cancer with his book, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. Professor Thomas Seyfried spoke to Dr. Robert Verkerk about the importance of understanding metabolic theory in order to develop successful therapies.
They're inherited risk factors. So BRCA1 is an inherited risk factor. The P53 mutation, the leaf rot, is an inherited risk factor. None of these genes by themselves are 100% penetrant. And as in genetics, we know causality is penetrance. So if everyone inheriting the BRCA gene would get breast cancer, then you would say the BRCA gene is the cause of that. The fact that you can have 50% of women with the BRCA gene and not get cancer indicates that the BRCA gene is not the primary cause of the disease. Now, the BRCA gene will damage mitochondria, forcing the cell into a fermentation metabolism, which all cancers have. All cancers are fermenters. So the common thread, as you've mentioned, Rob, is the metabolic destabilization inside the cell. So the cells ferment. All, as far as we can see, all cancers are fermenters, and they ferment because of damage to the respiration.
Yeah. So we can look in terms of the way in which respiration functions. Obviously, you've mentioned mitochondria. Again, for the lay public, could you just take us through a little bit of what is happening in terms of respiration and also perhaps explain how mitochondria fit into the picture? We've got them in virtually all cells in our body. And take it from there. Thank you.
Yeah, well, all cells in our body are respiring. We breathe air. If we, you know, the fact that we breathe air, oxygen, allows the mitochondria to function to generate energy. So without energy, nothing lives. So we have to recognize that. The bottom line for life is energy. And the energy comes from the mitochondria oxidative phosphorylation in large part. Cancer cells are very, very different than most normal cells in that they have they use fermentation, an ancient metabolic pathway that existed on all for all organisms before oxygen came into the atmosphere some 2.5 billion years ago. So cancer cells have fallen back on this ancient pathway. Why? Because their respiratory capacity has been damaged. How? That damage could come from carcinogens, it could come from radiation, it could come from viruses, it could come from aging, it could come from a lot of different things. The bottom line is cancer cells lose their capacity to generate energy through respiration, oxidative phosphorylation, and fall back on this ancient pathway of fermentation. And it is interesting. It is interesting that all cells that fermented before oxygen were highly proliferative, unbridled proliferation. So the cancer cell is doing nothing more than falling back on an ancient pathway that existed some 2.5 billion years ago.
Next up was a session looking at the role of oxygen in cancer. For this, we had US expert Dr. Scott Scher, a specialist in hyperbaric oxygen therapy, talking to one of the UK's leading integrative medicine doctors, Dr. Ariane Tavakoli of the Quantum Clinic in Sussex.
And I thought we'd start by just asking, why do we even need to think about oxygen in cancer? Because after all, it's all around us anyway. We're breathing it in all the time anyway. So why is it important to think about oxygen and oxygenation, which is the bringing of oxygen to the body's tissues, in the context of cancer? Can you explain that to us, please?
Of course. Yes, oxygen is kind of a big deal, as I like to say, and it's kind of my area that I focus on, of course. And it sounds like from what Robin described, some of you have already talked about oxygen in various capacities. What I do in a hyperbaric chamber is give more oxygen under pressure. But in general, cancer seems to have this very significant interplay with the amount of oxygen available locally and overall as well. Tumors tend to grow very fast. And when they do, they outstrip their blood supplies and they become hypoxic or low oxygen. And that's actually causing a stimulus locally for them to not only grow, but also to metastasize or spread. There's actually just an interesting paper that was released just about a month or two ago that showed that the more hypoxic a tumor, the less oxygen it has, the more risk you have or the tumor will have to spread from that original site. So what they did under this particular study design was actually they flooded it with oxygen. And two things happened that were interesting. One is that it didn't metastasize, number one. And number two, it actually, the primary tumor actually grew a little bit, which is interesting. And looking back at the previous material that I've reviewed and patients that I've seen over the years, all the studies in hyperbaric therapy, which we'll talk about, show that if you use hyperbaric therapy in the context of cancer, cancer does not grow per se in the chamber. I've never seen a study that's shown that. It's only ever shown either a mild regressive effect or a static effect against the cancer itself. But it's the combination, which is key, that really brings out the possibilities in a hyperbaric chamber. And that's why I often talk about hyperbaric therapy as being a synergistic tool. It's not a direct and primary cancer therapy. It is something that you add potentially to your cancer therapy regimen as a way to enhance outcomes. And I think that's really what we're talking about here, because if hypothetically it's going to increase the tumor size, which I've never seen, by the way, but if it was going to do that, if you didn't have metastasis, that's actually even a possibly a positive outcome, because then you have the potential to treat something locally, which is much more possible as far as curative kinds of potential, as opposed to something that's metastasized, which is very interesting. But in general, oxygen and cancer have a significant interplay. Cancer grows in hypoxic environments or low oxygen environments, and some cancers are well known, even more so, to be very treatment resistant And the reason for them to be treatment resistant is because they don't have a lot of oxygen in them or in the core of where the tumor is. So it's very difficult to get your therapies, whatever they are, whether it be chemotherapy, radiation, even natural therapies, to that tumor to try to treat it and try to eliminate it.
Next, another very important topic in cancer, hormones. Dr. Nasha Winters shared some of her in-depth insights into the role of hormones in discussion with Dr. Elizabeth Thompson of the National Centre for Integrative Medicine in the UK.
I'm just going to let you talk about how hormones play a role in cancer, in a good way or in a bad way. Just tell us a bit about that.
A little context about hormones. We have many little organs, little tissues in our body that all have this ability to release a chemical that talks to each other. So it's like our internal, internet. It's like our internal Facebook system is our hormonal system. So you're looking at things like your pituitary, your pineal gland, your hypothalamus, thyroid, parathyroid, pancreas, bone, adipose tissue or fat tissue, white blood cells, adrenal glands, and your gonads, your ovaries or your testes are your hormone glands, your hormone organs, and they all have different chemicals, different hormones that they release, and then they bounce off each other. So I'm giving you that framework. Imagine it as the center is you, your terrain, and then you've got this like web branching off of it of all those organs and tissues I talked about, and it's not very linear. It's all webbed out. They all interplay with one another, and so any one place where that communication gets bunky, gets really bogged up and weird, you cause a problem in the whole web, right? You cause feedback signals in the whole web. And so a lot of people, when they're studying, like even endocrinologists get quite myopic. They're like, they just focus on thyroid or just on the pancreas or just on the ovaries. When you do that, they forget that you tug on one part of that web and you're impacting the whole. So I want to give that context first. The thing about hormones and cancer is hormones themselves, and a lot of people, when I say hormones, most people jump immediately to estrogen or progesterone, but I'm talking also melatonin, insulin, cortisol and epinephrine, prolactin, all of the different hormone signalings that are coming from all of those different glands play a key role in this. So what I always teach patients is to understand the simplest framework of cancer and hormones in general, that you cannot ever separate them out. They come as a trifecta, is insulin. I call it the three S's. We'll start there. Sugar, sex, and stress. So that's insulin, hormones, and especially the sex hormones, and cortisol, the stress hormones. So when you think about that, they go as a team. They're like a little gang, all right? Mm. Those are the three biggest drivers of creating health or disease in many conditions, but in particular cancer, because they all offer up growth signals. They all offer up, like if you have elevated cortisol, you have a deficient immune system. So your body can't fight cancer very well if you haven't dealt with your stress. And guess what? If you have high cortisol, you also have elevated blood sugar. And if you have elevated blood sugar, you have all kinds of inflammatory oxidative stress process going on, more depleted immune function. You also then have all the metabolic signaling pathway problems going on. You also have issues of immune dysfunction because it often changes the microbiome distribution. Hopefully you get my point, is nothing happens in a vacuum. And interestingly, sugar stimulates estrogen and cortisol. Cortisol stimulates estrogen and sugar. Estrogen stimulates cortisol and sugar. My point is that a lot of people will get on, say, a blocking drug for their hormones, like tamoxifen or Arimidex, so an aromatase inhibitor or a selective estrogen receptor modifier. And they'll be like, I'm good, taking this drug, all set. But what they don't realize is those drugs are also very notorious for spiking blood sugar. They cause metabolic syndrome. They cause fatty liver and diabetes. The three main drivers for breast, ovarian, colorectal, non-small cell lung carcinoma, prostate, endometrial, ovarian cancers are low vitamin D3, which is a hormone, elevated insulin and sugar, and a body fat composition, not a BMI, but a body fat, because you can have tofis, thin on the outside, fat on the, you know, thin on the outside, fat on the inside, folks. So fatty liver, metabolic issues, even in your thin, you know, built people, those are the three drivers. So you're looking at growth factors from an imbalance in that hormonal communication.
For the last session of the Saturday, I had the honor of interviewing Dr. Patrick Hanaway, an extremely significant figure in integrative and functional medicine in the US. Our subject matter for this talk revolved around his experience of cancer and cancer treatment and the effect that this has had on his life. It was a wonderful interview.
So, yeah, that's something I'm definitely interested to talk to you about, is this the silver linings that are hidden in adversity, basically. It seems to be surprisingly commonly the case with cancer. The worst experience of our life produces the single most important change. And that change can revolutionize our life and send us off on a new, completely different, 100% more authentic path than the one we were on before. So I think this has been the case for you, if I'm not mistaken, that it really pushed you in a completely new direction unexpectedly.
Well, it did. And you know, part of the aspect of, you know, looking just energetically, like, okay, I had a cancer right here, right in the place where I speak from. Am I, you know, I asked the question, am I speaking the truth of what I'm feeling in my heart? Or am I doing what is politically expedient? And so I had to begin to ask myself that question. And I also saw that it became very clear very early on. I work with indigenous healers in the Wiradika tradition in the Sierra Madres in Mexico, Huichol, they're also known as. And it became clear to me where I went to see those healers and did some work before I started chemotherapy. Chemotherapy was going to be a couple weeks away. So I went down and did that. And it became clear to me that this was about transformation and that I actually needed to ask other people for help. I needed to bring people around me and receive what other people had to give. And so many people cared for me that it was like, oh, I've been trying to carry, I think my job is to carry the ball and to, you know, be a leader. And, you know, I'm going to put this on my back and follow me. And yet it's taken a toll. So how do I actually learn to receive, not just give, but receive? And one of those lessons for me is like, you can't really care for others until you're caring for yourself. You know, if you think you're caring for others and you're not caring for yourself, you're doing something else. You're actually, you know, you're codependently, you know, trying to get validated because you're caring for other people because you don't feel good about yourself. Well, that's a mixed message. You know, that's not pure caring and empathy and compassion. So, you know, these were, you know, some of the deeper lessons for me to be able to get at. And in that, recognizing, as you and I have talked about a little bit, that life is uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, the phone could ring for any of us right now, and there could be a message that changes the rest of our lives in ways that we could never imagine. Life is uncertain. We surround ourselves with comforts and with reserves to try to deal with those issues so that we feel safe, we feel comfortable, we feel certain. Indigenous people, they're living right at the edge of the world. You know, if it doesn't rain and the crops don't grow, their family and community will die. You know, so how do we, you know, in that uncertainty where we just don't know, that is where life is. So how do I engage that? How do I actually embrace it and feel, paradoxically, the aliveness of that uncertainty? It is there. And we're finding this with COVID-19. It's like life is uncertain. No one could ever have imagined a year ago what the last 6 months would be like. It would not be, it would be considered far too far-fetched for science fiction to say that this would happen. But look what's happened. And we're on, and it's uncertain. So how do we drop into beginning to be okay with uncertainty and to be able to open our hearts and relate to ourselves and our each other and the natural world in a way that is authentic, open-hearted.
Sunday morning started with a dive into what must have been foreign territory for the vast majority listening, nutrigenomics. This relatively recent science is throwing new light on the underlying differences between us that can result in such different outcomes from the same intervention. Top nutritionist Dawn Waldron and Emma Bezik, CEO of a nutrigenomics test provider, discuss the ways that these tests can inform a personalized approach to nutritional therapy.
I think nutrigenomics is really new to many, many people. They might have heard of it, but they probably wouldn't have done it, and they probably wouldn't really understand what it can do for them. So shall we pretend we're at the beginning of our journeys and just talk about what that is?
Yeah, sure, actually. You're in the best place to sort of say what is nutrigenomics, I think.
Yeah, okay, I'll give it a go. So nutrigenomics and nutrigenetics are kind of used interchangeably, and they are a specialism within genomics, genetics, DNA testing. A main difference between the general and the specific is that generally genomic medicine is about looking for a diagnosis. So it's trying to find which gene caused a particular disease. Nutrigenomics differs in two key ways. Firstly, it's about nutrition. So it's about what makes that person respond differently to different nutrients or require different nutrients, and that could be different forms of nutrients or different amounts of vitamins and minerals, for example. And that is due to small changes in your DNA. So they're very, very small changes, just single letters that can make quite a big difference. But it's more about how that can be changed by you. So it's not about diagnosing something that is inevitable. It's actually telling you, providing you with some information that helps you personalize your food, your environment, so that it's suited to you, so that it's supportive of you rather than working against you.
Yeah, I think that's great. And that's the really important thing, this idea that we can change the way our genes work, which is not a concept that's normally taught when genetics is maybe taught at school. So a lot of people think that the genetic code is set in stone, and we don't really understand the impact of the various environmental impacts on the way our genes work, or indeed the how significant nutrition is. So we often think of nutrition or nutrigenetics as an added extra or something else that you might look at, whereas in actual fact it is fundamental. So there's a researcher who I sort of try to read everything he pops up with, a chap called Michael Fenech, and he talks about the nutriome. So this is the idea that we each have an individual nutrient requirement that, you know, yours would differ from mine, Emma, but that we are en route to be able to calculate that. And, you know, at some point in the future, in, you know, 2045 maybe, we'll be able to put our DNA in and have a personally tailored supplement plan. The idea being that it will exactly match what we need.
Mushrooms took center stage for the next session, medicinal mushrooms. The power of them to support recovery and health has been known about for centuries, but now there is also the science to underpin that knowledge. Mark Bennett's a functional medicine practitioner who regularly supports people with cancer through treatment and recovery, and who often relies on medicinal mushrooms in this endeavor. In this session, he talked to mushroom expert Romina Malwani. Here, they tackle a question from the audience about combining medicinal mushrooms and conventional treatments.
One of the these questions, and it's quite interesting. The question that came up is, how do we know a specific mushroom does not interact with chemotherapy treatments, and how do we know which specific mushrooms enhance the activity of cancer treatments? And I think that is the heart of what we're talking about here, Mark.
Very, very good questions. And I mean, clearly, one has to be very careful when one is integrating therapies, okay? And, you know, when one is working alongside modern medicine, which is what we do, you know, we've got to be clear about this. We're not alternative, we are complementary. So my cancer patients are working under oncologists, you know, that's how it works. But what is interesting is that there's a huge amount of debate over whether, for example, turmeric and berberine and all kinds of other different supplements should be used or will be used or advisable to be used alongside chemotherapy protocols. And the issue here is about CYP450 enzymes and what we know through the liver detoxification enzymes. And what we know through the research with medicinal mushrooms is that actually it does not interfere with the detoxification of, for example, the chemotherapy agents. Now, the little I know about the oncologist world, you know, I'm not an oncologist, I'm not a doctor, you know, so I'm not in that world, but I completely understand and respect their position from the point of view that if they are trying to use a toxic compound, which effectively is what a chemotherapy agent is, therapeutically, to help the client achieve control of their cancer, then they are naturally and correctly going to be exceedingly nervous about any additional factors that are potentially going to speed up or slow down the detoxification of that chemotherapy agent, because that could actually be disastrous. You know, it could actually mean that the client doesn't get enough of the particular agent for long enough to do the particular job, or you actually slow down the excretion, which means it becomes dangerous. So this is where mushrooms are genuinely genius.
Another very hot topic followed for the next session. Jane McClelland, author of How to Starve Cancer, talked to Travis Christofferson, author of Tripping Over the Truth, about the emerging science of repurposed drugs.
And so to kind of drill down into where your lines of reasoning into your attempt to, you know, to find more, because you realize that the standard of care, you know, was going to, didn't offer what you needed. There was two sort of aspects to that. You found you were researching the cancer cell. What can you target, right? You had come to the conclusion that genetics, it was very difficult, but you found this sort of simplistic approach targeting these fuel lines.
Yeah.
And then exactly. the second quest was, once you realize that, was, okay, well, what's out there to inhibit these sort of main lines of fuel sources for a cancer cell? Yeah. So why don't you talk a little bit about that scientific journey?
Okay. So discovering that glucose really was a major factor in cancer was a light bulb moment, and it wasn't particularly known back then. And I was given the usual, you know, it doesn't matter what you eat, keep eating what you want, it won't make any difference. But I didn't accept that. I thought that at the very least it would slow it down. And I was trying to buy myself as much time as possible, you know. Stage four for my type of cancer only has an average survival of 12 weeks. You know, I was looking for any kind of extension to my life, and the glucose thing was massive. And I did find out about Otto Warburg and his work a little bit. I didn't go into too much depth, but, you know, there were various factors that stuck out back then that glucose was a big factor. And then I also looked into IGF-1, and I knew that was related to meat and to dairy. so that was another road. So I cut out the meat, and, you know, initially, I actually went down the macrobiotic diet route, which was tough. But I did that for about 3 months. And then I sort of morphed into more of a paleo pescatarian diet. But that, you know, it was a learning process all the way through. And I'm still learning, you know, every day I find something new. And my Metromut, which I know you're familiar with and a lot of people watching are familiar with, it's growing. Yeah. There are more aspects and things. I'm trying to keep it simple for people to look at. And it is a complex thing that I've done, but I've tried to, you know, the metabolism of cancer, if you look at a normal metabolic map, if you like, it's all over the place. There are things coming in from all sorts of different angles. And I have tried to simplify it into sort of the three macros of the diet. So you just look at fat, protein and carb, and the carb being glucose, the protein being predominantly glutamine, and the fat being fatty acids, etc. But I mean, you know, ketones, as you have just written, I believe. I haven't read it yet. I need to read your book. But yeah, I recognize that acetate was a potential issue, and trying to block a particular pathway, you know, the SREP1 and the SREP2, those were really quite key. But I didn't discover those. You know, what I did was have this thought in my head that I had to block those three macros somehow. And I think my training as a physio and looking into nutrition, I've done all sorts of, you know, I've trained as an aromatherapist. I've done all sorts of things in my life to sort of gather knowledge. I'm always looking, always learning. And I just had this sort of big macro picture of what was going on. I wasn't, and I think this is where researchers and maybe some scientists get a little bit stuck, because they go down their avenue and then they're quite sure that that's the answer. And they almost don't look anywhere else because they're convinced they've got it, you know, whereas I'm going, hang on a minute, I'm the patient. I'm keeping my eyes and ears open all the time. I'm like scanning everywhere just for sort of little snippets here and there and trying to pick up little bits of info everywhere I can. and just adding that into my sort of overall picture. And that, I think that's how I formulated my triangle, and eventually just scouring and really digging away, trying to look at all the research. And it suddenly became clear that, you know, blocking one route suddenly made this other route much more active. Or if you block that one, then it made this other route on the other side really active. And so I was starting to look at this pattern of if you block one route, you got to block this other one at the same time. Otherwise, it's not going to work. You know, this is how cancer manages to adapt and reroute. And it was this adaptation and flexibility, which was only recognized, I think, in 2011 as a sort of a general hallmark of cancer that I'd kind of recognized before, instinctively, I think, and recognized that I needed a combination. I knew that HIV had this combination of drugs, and it was doing the whole cocktail together, which was a scary thing for me. No, I didn't know anybody who'd done anything like that, you know, and taken a cocktail of off-label drugs. I was kind of like stepping into new territory that I felt was completely unknown. I mean, I do liken it. I've always likened it to trying to cross the Atlantic Ocean with absolutely no guidance whatsoever in fog on my boat and just having no map, no chart. Off I go.
Next, someone who would be a good contender for the title Father of Integrative Oncology. Dr. Keith Block has been pioneering full integration at his clinic in the USA for decades and has created much of the groundwork on which we stand today. I was honoured to be able to interview him for Your Life and Cancer.
One of my mentors used to say, Keith, if you stand in the middle of the road, you'll get hit by cars on both sides. I built a career in the middle of the road, you know, literally on the median strip. And I did, because I saw early on two camps, and they were really different camps. There was a mainstream camp that I believe had blinders on about the health of patients. And I saw those patients often responding to treatment, but beating up something silly from the treatments. And then I saw an alternative camp that not always, but often looked like they were in terrific shape and they felt well, but their diseases were migrating in the wrong direction. And when we brought both of these systems together in a model of care, when I would give the alternative group and move them onto some conventional therapies done in more innovative ways, or I took the kind of conventional group and started giving them really aggressive and personalized lifestyle interventions, there was no question whatsoever. It was clear that the middle ground was the optimal ground. And that's really kind of where we, you know, ended up, you know, with this. I don't have any question today that, you know, the mainstream treatments, you know, people can tolerate them better and get better results if you build a proper foundation for them in terms of, you know, individualized, personalized integrative care. And the same I would say for alternative groups is that it's very easy to get locked into one therapy or another instead of looking more broadly about what really works for patients. And that's really what's driven my 40-year career doing this. So
I love that. What really works, that's the key to it. Well, that's standing in the middle of the road. You survived. And I think you've got a bit of a central reservation built up there now. There's a little bit of a crash barrier on each side. There's a certain amount of security now that you created, really. And, you know, you're such a pioneer in this area. You know, you're the leader, really, as far as I see it, in really taking seriously the potential of bringing the two together. Our final session on Sunday was a brilliant discussion between two top scientists, Dr. Valter Lungo, author of The Longevity Diet and creator of the Fast Mimicking Diet, and Miguel Toribio Mateus, neuroscientist, nutritionist and microbiome researcher. Together, they explored some of the many facets of diet as a supportive therapy. Here they are talking about ketogenics.
A subject that many of us are really intrigued by is, and a lot of people are doing, is these ketogenic diets or high protein diets, which are, some of them overlap. So they tend to feature some of the features of the fast mimicking diet, like the low, extreme low carb, for example, or really low carb. But they tend to also have high protein. So some people are using these for all sorts of things, including cancer protection, or as an adjuvant to a cancer therapy. So what would be your thoughts on those? Because they are really incredibly trendy, at least in the UK. And I know in the States, probably the same, you know, this keto and paleo and all this kind of stuff that tends to be really high on protein. Obviously, I'm thinking of the MTA pathways and all this kind of stuff, which are very sensitive to an excess of amino acids from proteins. So what would be your thoughts on this?
Well, the research suggests that some cancers love ketogenic diets and some cancers hate ketogenic diets. So it just depends on what you get. And but the research, including and especially our own, suggests that cancers love growth factors, love proteins. You know, so if it's a ketogenic diet and it's high in protein, it's probably a mistake. I would say, you know, bad idea until there is a big randomized clinical trial showing efficacy. And even then, I will argue that it would have been much better to do a fasting mimicking diet. So to the protein restriction, add the sugar restriction and add the calorie restriction. Right? I mean, this is really, if you look at a recent paper in Nature, it's very clear that by going after, and in that case, glucose, this was hormone therapy and breast cancer. Of course, the mechanistic results are in mice, and then we had also patients from two different clinical trials. But the in that case, sugar didn't even matter, right? It was irrelevant. What mattered was IGF-1, controlled by proteins, insulin, controlled in part by proteins, and leptin. So I think it's, again, we need to move away from improvisation. Improvisation, I would guess, it's going to cause more damage than good. But I understand that patients sometimes are desperate and the science is not moving as quickly as it should. I started a foundation both in the United States and in Italy called Create Cures. And that's what we're trying to do now. We started a clinic, a foundation clinic in Los Angeles, and trying to navigate this, you know, to make sure that patients have the ability to take advantage of the latest science without improvising.
both weekends featured a long Monday night session devoted entirely to Q&A with a panel of experts, and these were themselves fascinating sessions. And the great news is that all the sessions from both weekends are available as recordings for the next 6 months. Just go to yourlifeandcancer.com, click Program and choose Purchase the Recordings. Also, do note that the on-demand wellness area, also under the program menu on the website, features a wealth of experts leading you through a huge selection of therapies and practices to support your well-being. These are all completely free to you and have been provided free by the featured practitioners. I want to say a last thank you to all the experts who freely gave their time and expertise to make this event possible, and the many UK organisations who came together to give their support to it. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed these samples and will want to hear more. I'll be back again at the same time next week with another regular Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.